From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 2 decades after Ronald Reagan's grand vision of the Star Wars missile defense program, top U.S. Air Force officials are pushing toward a new vision of space weaponry and warfare. And this one looks a lot more like the George Lucas vision of Star Wars. High-speed space planes, killer micro-satellites, lethal laser beams and radio waves from the high frontier. The Air Force is seeking administration approval for a national security directive that would take the United States a step closer to deploying space weapons. Billions of dollars have already been invested. Proponents believe that national security means military supremacy in space. Critics claim militarizing space may mean disaster on Earth. Tonight on Point, the new debate over American military strategy in space. Joining me now from New York is Tim Weiner, reporter for the New York Times. He recently laid out the remarkable breadth and depth of U.S. Air Force ambitions in space. Tim Weiner, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
You bet.
So what are they looking for from President Bush exactly?
The Air Force has a long history going back to the 1950s of ambitious proposals for space weaponry. General Homer Bushy declared in 1958 that we needed to put nuclear missiles on the moon, for example. There were propositions for space planes that would be powered by nuclear explosions. What's new now is that in 2001, a commission led by Donald Rumsfeld, then the newly nominated defense secretary, said that the military should, quote, ensure that the president will have the option to deploy weapons in space. And since then, Air Force leadership, and particularly General Lance Lord, who leads the Air Force Space Command, have laid out a doctrine of space superiority, which is defined as, quote, freedom to attack as well as freedom from attack, unquote, in space.
Tim, there is a 1996 Clinton administration policy. How would what the Air Force is pushing for now differ from the 96 policy?
Well, in order for this doctrine to become something more than rhetoric, three things have to happen. One, the President of the United States would have to revise American military space policy. And he will do that in some form in a presidential directive sometime in coming weeks. Now, we may not know everything that says because national security directives issued by presidents sometimes are classified. So there may be a public portion of this directive, and there may be a classified directive. If the president approves the Air Force doctrine for space superiority, then Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, in the upcoming quadrennial defense review, where he kind of takes every 4 years a big picture look at what the American military should look like down the road,
yes,
would have to go ahead and approve that kind of weaponry, and then Congress would have to finance it.
And we're talking very large money here, hundreds of billions, maybe trillions of dollars.
Well, remember, not every space weapon is a weapon in space. In other words, you could endeavor to build a network of ground-based lasers that would bounce off space satellites, or build a military space plane, a version of the space shuttle, that would carry weaponry and fight its way through space, and those would not be weapons in space. If you wanted to build a space-based system of lasers and other weaponry, you are talking, according to most estimates, about hundreds of billions of dollars.
Now, Tim, of course, Ronald Reagan's Star Wars program at this point is 20-plus years on, $100 billion plus on, and Pentagon officials, as you report, say they still cannot reliably detect and destroy a threat. With all of those years and all of that money, has that encouraged or discouraged further development of space weapons?
Well, in a way, it's encouraged it, in my estimation, because the United States is theoretically vulnerable to missile attack. I think any nation that would threaten the United States with an intercontinental ballistic missile should know that their country would be a smoking, radiating ruin in about 2 hours. But the threat is there. So far, the Missile Defense Agency, whose work began 22 years ago and $100 billion ago, has not produced a working system. So Air Force Space Command and others in the Air Force think that there may be a role for space weaponry to wipe out land-based threats to the United States, as well as to protect American space satellites, which are crucial to military and intelligence missions.
To that end, you described the launch in April already of an experimental microsatellite that would do what, Tim?
Well, the XSS-11 is an experimental space satellite. It has the theoretical ability to, if it works, be adapted for an anti-satellite mission. It is not an anti-satellite weapon. It has the technical capability to evolve into one.
You described something else called Rods from God, another Air Force space program. There's the nickname. What is it? What does it mean?
That's a concept that has been kicking around for some years. Only a concept. They haven't built this. The idea is that you could hurl down long cylinders of uranium, titanium, that would hit with substantial force against buried targets, substantial kinetic energy.
On Earth, with the force of a small nuclear weapon, as you describe it.
Well, a very small one. Mm. It depends on how many rods you bundle into this system called hypervelocity rod bundles. It would certainly hit with the force of tons or tens of tons of TNT.
No one owns space. There's no national turf up there at this point. So what are other American allies and otherwise saying about this this push for U.S. space superiority?
Well, I think other nations regard space as a global commons. And I think that the strategic doctrine that some in the Air Force are pushing here, would regard it as a strategic commons where America must dominate as it presently dominates the skies and the sea and the land.
But allies are saying, no, not the heavens, not space.
There's not a lot of international enthusiasm that I can detect for space weaponry. There isn't going to be a huge arms race in space because I can't think of another nation that could afford to build the technology necessary to create offensive counter space operations. However, if the United States were to, in 10 years or 20 years, create space-based weapons, then other nations might try to counter them with lasers or other counter strategies.
No arms race in space, at least for now, but it sounds like a lot more to come here. Tim Weiner, thank you so much for your reporting, and thanks for joining us tonight.
You bet, Tom.
Tim Weiner, reporter for the New York Times. He spoke with us from New York. We're talking tonight about the Air Force seeking approval from the White House for a freer hand in making military plans for space. You can join the conversation should the Air Force be pursuing American space supremacy, space weaponry. And is U.S. military dominance of the heavens the best path, the necessary path, to peace on Earth, to national security, or not? Join us, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Montgomery, Alabama, is Everett Dolman, professor of comparative military studies at the School of Advanced Air and Space Studies at Maxwell Air Force Base. He is space theorist for Air University, the Center for Professional Military Education for the U.S. Air Force. Everett Dolman, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you for inviting me.
What, strategically speaking, what is the basic consideration that you bring to the heavens, to space? When the U.S. military, when the U.S. government looks up there with its national security obligations in mind, how does it, how should it see space?
Well, space is viewed by many in the military as the ultimate high ground. It is that most desirable or most advantageous territory that must, at a minimum, if you cannot control it, must at a minimum be kept from the control of others. It gives the potential, it gives the United States already global presence, in other words, global surveillance over the world, and it allows us to have a much smaller, faster, more lethal and deadly fighting force around the world. Without space support today, without what we get from space in our military today...
That is satellite tracking and so on.
Satellite tracking, communications, weather, navigation support, and the like, The United States military would not be able to fight in the way it has now trained to fight. The process is called transformation, and it's a process that arguably has been going on informally since the Vietnam War, but certainly formally for the last half decade. And it is in progress. Nonetheless, if space were somehow to go away, if it were denied to U.S. forces today, it would have to assume a defensive posture, withdraw from many of the areas it's in the world today, and could not contemplate some of the capacities to influence events abroad that it has over the last several years.
Do you see militarization of space, American military supremacy in space, as inevitable, Everett Dolman?
Well, nothing's inevitable, but it would be highly desirable from my point of view. As was already mentioned on the show tonight, the United States already is supreme in the air and at sea and on land, at least where it has its forces. Supremacy is the way, is the military doctrine of the United States in its new way of fighting war. It plans to use space just as it uses the air, almost without question, in its supreme capacity. It wants the ability to move through the air, to have effects from the air. It wants the ability to move through space and have effects from the space without interference from any other potential enemies. And that is simply the way that the United States fights now.
Freedom to attack, freedom from attack in space. It's quite a concept. Everett Dolman, please stick with us. There's a lot we want to talk about tonight. Of course, there are major objections to the strategy as well. We'll look at those. The U.S. Air Force is pushing for American military supremacy in space. You can join our conversation should the U.S. move now for military dominance of the high frontier of space. Is the militarization of space inevitable? Is it practical? Is it affordable? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking tonight about the U.S. Air Force push for American military supremacy in space. You can join the conversation tonight. What do you think? Is the militarization of space practical? Is it affordable? Is it a good idea? Is keeping space weapons-free by treaty or agreement an option? Is it realistic? Would that be good sense? And what is your gut reaction to weapons in space? Inevitable or the wrong idea? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight from Montgomery, Alabama, by Everett Dolman, Professor of Comparative Military Studies at the School for Advanced Air and Space Studies at Maxwell Air Force Base. He's space theorist for the U.S. Air Force at the Air University. And right now from Newport, Rhode Island, by Joan Johnson Freeze. She's chair of the Department of National Security Decision-Making at the Naval War College. She's author of the forthcoming book, Heavenly Ambitions, about U.S. military ambitions in space. Joan Johnson Freeze, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
So we've all seen this laid out for us now very publicly. Big ambitions, lots of strategic changes, kind of the high frontier in the gun sights here, lots of money to be dedicated up there. Is it a good idea? Is it necessary, Joan Johnson Freeze?
Well, I think the issue, quite simply, is whether or not space-based weapons or space weapons used in space for either offensive or defensive purposes will produce a long-term increase in the relative military capability of the United States, or whether it will actually serve to decrease current military dominance. And I think that while the U.S. might gain a short-term advantage, in the long term, the benefits are likely to be very marginal and temporary if an enemy shifts the terms of engagement, which it certainly would. Space-based weapons offer an enemy a number of interesting targeting options that would be potentially devastating to the United States. So the advantage the U.S. military currently enjoys would be put at risk by space weapons.
Take us through that analysis, Joan Johnson Freeze. You say short-term advantage, long-term serious risk. What's the targeting, potential targeting by enemies you're talking about? What's the vulnerability that space supremacy might open up?
Well, as it's already been mentioned, that space is viewed as the ultimate high ground, and spacecraft are governed by astrodynamics. They are highly predictable. Therefore, unlike aircraft that are, you know, can easily get out of the way or hide, spacecraft are highly predictable, and therefore they're, in some respects, sitting ducks, and there are lots of options for attacking space weapons. For example, if timed correctly, sending a missile into space with sand as its payload that is then released in orbit can act as an anti-satellite weapon, inflicting considerable damage or destroying U.S. spacecraft passing through it because of the velocity of the sand. And the U.S. has more assets in space than anyone else. So we could be making ourselves more vulnerable.
But how many countries have the capacity even to lift a bag of sand into space?
Well, there are a number that can, but even beyond that, if the United States used its own space weapons and destroyed another satellite, the debris created there could become then a threat to our own spacecraft.
And if the U.S. doesn't develop space supremacy, military supremacy in space, is it not at risk of someone else doing it?
Oh, by all means, the United States needs to have space supremacy. There's also a difference between space supremacy and space dominance. But I think what we're seeing here is with the Bush administration, there's been a very important policy shift that's occurred, that rather than weaponizing space as a last resort, now the United States is leading the way very rapidly and with very little or no public awareness or even analysis by the experts toward testing and deploying space weapons. So I think you can convince me, but so far I have not been convinced that neither it's necessary or that this is the right time.
So we've got a voice from the Naval War College speaking to a thinker from the Air University in Everett Dolman. Here's a critical view. Joan Johnson Free says a military position in space is inherently vulnerable.
I've heard this argument quite a bit and read some recent articles on it. The fact is that the high ground has always been visible. The advantages of the high ground through history are that you have greater surveillance, greater range given equal technology, and greater force. The advantage is so high that even though the opponent presumably knows where you are on the high ground, it's worth taking for the trade-off. Now, we're also talking about the ability to see satellites in space. Most of that comes from the United States, from NORAD, that tracks objects in space larger than about 5 or 6 inches in diameter, and publishes that information freely. There's no other state out there that has the capacity to track objects in space. And just because you can see it up there doesn't mean you can hit it. Only two nations in history have been able to do so, and those with very expensive and very difficult programs, the United States and the Soviet Union. So it is a tough, tough assignment.
Now, explain that to us. We hear more and more about commercial launches heading mm-hmm. for space. We hear about even Richard Branson, Virgin Airlines, you know, getting into like space or near space, taking tourists up there. We hear about China developing a space program. Japan, of course, has its own, other nations. Is it really that exclusive a club?
It's getting to be less and less so, and I certainly hope that tourist flights will come up while I'm still able to take one. The United States should, as it does in its protection of the seas, ensure that all states can go into space and commercially develop the efforts in space. As was mentioned earlier, there's no nation that stakes space out. That is the result of international treaty that forbids nations from claiming territory, that forbids corporations from going to space and making a profit from what they find there. We need a new legal regime as well. But the United States, in dominating space, simply needs to ensure that weapons do not go there. And just as the United States Navy ensures freedom of the seas, it could be done for space, too, and still allow the rest of the world to go into space and commercially develop it.
Joan Johnson Free's Everett Dolman says, yes, there's vulnerability to being in space, but the advantages of dominating that highest of high grounds offset the vulnerability. What do you say?
Well, again, in the short term, that's possible. I find it ironic that the way to prevent being put in space is for the United States to put them there. But
the way to prevent weapons in space.
What was just said is the way to prevent weapons being put in space is that we should put them there so that others don't, which seems a bit ironic. But again, you don't have to hit these weapons. You can paint chip in space can damage or destroy a spacecraft.
So something has to hit them, right? I mean, even a paint chip, but something has
to. Well, a marble-sized piece of debris in mm-hmm. orbit impacts a satellite with about the same energy as a one-ton safe dropped from the top of a five-story building. So it does. You don't have to hit it with a lot of energy. You have to hit it with a large object. A small object carries with it a large amount of energy. There is also the problem that space weapons, because they can be considered predictable and to at least some extent fragile or vulnerable, there's an incentive to use them first, preemptively, use it or lose it. To do that, you need a lot of space surveillance that we were just talking about. The United States has a considerable amount of space surveillance, but not enough, I would argue, to risk making a mistake. I don't think we want to be the first country to use a weapon in space and then have to make a big oops. That was space debris that damaged our satellite, not a hostile action. We've had enough problems with bad intel recently. I don't think we want to put ourselves into a situation of not knowing what we're shooting at. So a first step, I would argue, would be much more space surveillance.
Everett Dolman, what about that? I was reading testimony today from Teresa Hitchens from the Center for Defense Information. She says that it's her belief that this is an extremely dangerous strategy. She says it will create a situation where all of our satellites are targets, military or not, whereas right now no one is threatening the U.S. in space. She said simply deploying any satellite weapons or space weapons, not even using them, could increase the odds of accidental war, including accidental nuclear war, and escalate conflicts in a crisis situation beyond where they ought to go. What do you say?
Well, that's a terrific point. I mean, when we talk about launching a medium-range ballistic missile to low Earth orbit altitude and detonating a bag of sand there, that capability exists today, in theory. We are vulnerable now to other states attempting to saturate low Earth orbit with debris that would take everyone out of the space equation. The question is, are we more vulnerable to that when we have a weapon in space that has, in theory, the capability to knock that missile down before it can detonate? In fact, for a global capability, space is the only place where such a defensive capability could be done. Now, any comprehensive weapon system is going to require a much larger space awareness capability, surveillance satellites, and a much less expensive space lift capability as well. Teresa Hitchens' argument, however, reminds me, I'm a boy from Montana, reminds me of the first time I went to New York, and my spouse-to-be said, don't look anyone in the eye, don't go into bad neighborhoods. We can hope that the rest of the world doesn't do anything if we don't weaponize space, but the fact is, if we have the capability to weaponize space, we do so before other states can. Are we more vulnerable than we were? I don't know that I buy that argument.
Well, talk about Star Wars. It sounds just like it, George Lucas style, here tonight. I want to begin to bring our callers in here. Everett Dolman, Joan Johnson-Fries, please stand by. Carl is calling from Boston. Hi, Carl, you're on the air. What do you think?
Carl, this is Carl from Bourne, right?
Yes, good to have you. Welcome.
I'm sorry. Here's my question. I'd like to go to whether this is really strategically sensible. Let's set aside whatever moral issues there may be about putting weapons in space. We have a wonderful comparative advantage in space right now, and it's all about passive sensors and communications nodes. If we weaponize space...
You mean the satellites that are already up there?
The satellites that are already up there. If we weaponize space with active weapons, that changes competitors' calculations entirely, and it basically invites them into making investments in an area where we currently enjoy such a terrific comparative advantage. You know, missiles only became a problem in Cuba, or rather Cuba, or Russians' militarization of Cuba in 1962 became a problem when he put missiles there, not when he had antennas there.
So why introduce the kind of weapons that will ultimately, that might ultimately be a threat to our own American assets in space?
No, it's the what you want to do is dissuade nations from investing in space, not encouraging them.
Carl, we've got it, and thank you very much for your call. Everett Dolman, that sounds like a challenge to you. What about the idea of just keeping weapons out of space, of dissuade nations, that the United States will sort of paint its own difficult future if it introduces weapons there?
Well, the point I think that the caller is trying to make, and I think it's a valid one, is what will the reaction of the world be? And it will not be positive. We can be sure of that. I think Tim Weiner, who was on earlier, made the case that a direct arms race in space is not likely there, given the preeminent position that the United States already has, what Carl called the comparative advantage that we have. Remember, though, we got that comparative advantage on a technology and innovation base. Today, we have dozens of people who support the single combatant in the field. We have to stay on top of that technological wave, if you will, as we move to the fourth-generation warfare of the future. And part of that is protecting, dominating, and developing capacities for space.
Joan Johnson-Fries, how about it? I mean, who wouldn't dream of not pushing warfare, war, into space? I mean, it's a beautiful and compelling idea. Is it not possible? Is the only way to secure national security to put weapons up there? You say there's a big downside here, but would it be possible to come to some kind of earthly agreement simply not to do it?
Well, you know, I think I agree with many of the points that have been made. And, you know, I think here we're a lot of times we're arguing about the how, not the why. But if we put weapons in space, we can be sure others will. If we don't, can we be sure they won't? Not really. But if we put weapons in space, we can be sure that other countries will focus on the goal of deterring us or potentially being able to asymmetrically deal with those weapons. What we've done in the past is a strategy called hedging, where we certainly want to be on top and ahead of everyone else in our research and development, but we have never moved into the testing and deployment phase, and I think that's the big difference now. I would also point out that in August 2003, 174 nations voted yes on a UN resolution to prevent an arms race in space, and only four countries abstained: Micronesia, the Marshall Islands, Israel, and the United States. Mm. So while countries may not be able to immediately respond with a technological challenge to us, it would certainly change the equation that they would be working under in terms of dealing with the United States.
And ultimately, somewhere, somehow, someone will. David's calling from Greensboro, North Carolina. Hi, David, you're on the air. What do you think?
I think it's one of the worst ideas that I've ever heard. When you have a deficit like we already have, and then to invest billions of dollars. We have troops in the field in two countries that are being killed right and left by car bombs, landmines, snipers. What would this next generation of satellites do? Just watch people down the ground? That's ridiculous. That's ridiculous. It just seems like every failed policy in the last half century has now come back in this administration, and everyone just stands around and tries to rationalize insanity.
David, we've got that perspective loud and clear, and I appreciate your calling in. Everett Dolman, two layers to that, maybe. First, what about the cost of this? I mean, President Reagan's Star Wars vision, $100 billion, 20 years, and it still doesn't work. Is this a money pit, a bottomless money pit? And finally, there's been a lot of talk about what air warfare cannot do. It doesn't seem to be able to win a war in Iraq. So is this, in some sense, ultimately superfluous, what might go up into space, as David suggests? In that way, kind of a mockery of the pain and death on the ground.
Yeah, well David made some compelling points. The first one is on the cost, the tremendous cost. It will be very, very expensive. And the question then is, what are we foregoing? Well, we're not going to use the savings from something we haven't even spent yet to take down the national debt. We're not going to take money from education or from housing to build space weapons.
But it doesn't make the debt any less.
The money for that will come from the existing defense budget. Now, as long as the United States is going to have a defense budget and going to have a foreign policy that means we will use our military around the world when needed, then you have to ask, how do you want to structure this? And as David pointed out, there are people dying on the ground today who, if we had space weapons, might not have to do so.
Really? I mean, how does it help the guy who's driving along and there's a dead dog with a bomb in it?
Well, the question is, why is the guy there driving that along and what is going on? In fact, we're mentioning the war is not going well. Well, the war went extremely well. It was over in just 10 days. What is going very badly is the occupation.
How does space weapons help rebuild a country, help create democracy, help win respect for the United States?
They don't. And I'm not sure any military unit can build a nation or create democracy. That is a mission that is sort of Vietnam-era style mission, that the process of transformation was getting rid of those sort of police and occupational duties. And when Iraq came along after 9/11, the call now is to go back to that kind of a mission, to put more humans into that area. We have developed some sort of an idea of 100% perfection, that unless Iraq becomes a very friendly and very capable and very economically stable democracy, somehow we would have failed. Maybe that's the case. But to ask the military to do these things is perhaps the wrong thing. And that brings up another point about the Air Force. It is not the Air Force is pushing that we must have weapons in space and no other thing. The Air Force would love very much for diplomatic solutions or economic solutions to take care of this. But the Air Force has been given the job, in this case, to protect and defend the assets of space and ensure they're available whenever they're needed by civilian and military users. The Air Force tools are weapons. If you want some other means, diplomacy, et cetera, to prevail, then don't give the Air Force that mission.
Mm. Well, those are the tools that are being pushed for right now. Thanks for that call from Greensboro. Everett Dolman, Joan Johnson-Fries, please stick with us. We're talking tonight about the U.S. Air Force push for American military supremacy in space. You can join the conversation. With so many satellite assets in space, is there an option to not mounting a defense? And is space battle as inevitable today as air warfare was at the beginning of the 20th century or not? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the U.S. Air Force push for President Bush to sign off on a policy of American military supremacy in space. You can join the conversation tonight. Is George Lucas's Star Wars fantasy the reality of America's military future? Does it have to be that way? Does war go wherever humans go? Or does this sound like bad strategy? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joined tonight from Montgomery, Alabama, by Everett Dolman, space theorist at the Air University of the U.S. Air Force, and from Newport, Rhode Island, and the Naval War College, Joan Johnson-Fries, chair of the Department of National Security Decision-Making there. And right now, Dale is calling from Hyde Point, North Carolina. Hi, Dale. You're on the air.
Thanks. First of all, I wish some of the world leaders would, and especially Mr. Bush, because he's professed to be of a spiritual nature. How about trying to solve problems peacefully? Now, we're in Iraq right now. Erroneously, don't get me wrong, I'm glad Saddam Hussein is no longer in power, but anyone who knows anything at all knows that Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11.
But when you look to space, Dale, what about the argument that there are threats, they must be met for national security?
I tell you what, Mr. Ashbrook, I think it's just a matter of time before something very catastrophic happens, either in testing or actually deploying space weapons. And I know we're not necessarily talking about space weapons hanging around waiting for something to happen, but I do believe there are other ways, other means of settling dispute. We are supposed to be living in a civilized world, and I know people sometimes act uncivilized, but Americans, and I'm speaking for everyone, I'm a GI, okay? I'm a disabled vet. I was in the Marine Corps, and by the grace of God, I never had to, I've been shot at, but not in combat. And I thank God for that.
But you say there's got to be, there should be another way. Like what, Dale?
Sir, we are the most powerful nation in the world economically. I mean, we're going through a bad time right now. But militarily, we're second to none. Second to none. And I would hazard to say our closest competitor is a distant second. So what are we worried about?
So don't rush to it. Don't militarize up there too quickly. Dale, thank you for your call. Joan Johnson-Fries, help us with this, because I mean, we can see the decks being cleared here. Tim Weiner mentioned at the top of the hour the report from Donald Rumsfeld. Even before he became Secretary of Defense, recommending that the military should, to quote him in that report, ensure that the president will have the option to deploy weapons in space. 2002. Following up on that commission report, we see President Bush withdrawing from the ABM treaty, which banned space weapons. A lot of listeners will think tonight, do we have to take this into space? Couldn't we keep that weapons free? You see what the Air Force is doing. Is there a way to both have national security and do less of this, invest less in this, put less firepower up there?
Well, I would see this as a problem that needs to be attacked from multiple approaches. First, I think I would advocate, and there are many others who are advocating this at the Stimson Center and other places, that we do need to get back into space arms control, but not from a technology control perspective as we have in the past.
What's the alternative?
Well, I think we need to start with rules of the road. In every other battle space, we have rules of engagement, where if two ships are passing, how close does one have to get to the other before it's considered a threat that can be responded to? We have nothing in space. We need to sit down and determine when is there a threat. When one satellite approaches another satellite, at what point does it become a threat?
So there's a kind of a rules of the road to figure out, but of course, you know, the argument is that real enemies won't follow rules of the road.
Well, I would hope that that does not negate the value of laws and basically laying out parameters for what is acceptable and what isn't. If, in fact, someone violates a rule of the road, I think we then have certainly justification for a response. But to simply decide on our own to preemptively take out a threat and perhaps be wrong about it is then opening space to a Wild West environment that would not be to our benefit. But along with this, we need to further enhance our force enhancement. We're talking here about space in terms of weaponization, but I couldn't agree more with everything that's been said about force enhancement.
Meaning?
All the capabilities that we use to fight wars, GPS, comm satellites.
The space-supported force enhancement,
you're
for that.
Exactly. And we are very good at that. We must remain redundant, have backup systems, and we need to hedge on the weaponry. But we don't need to take this time when we are so dominant to move forward. And the last point I would make is that we need a lot more analysis. We need analysis as to what would be the theoretical and the policy and the political outcomes so that we don't get unintended consequences. And we also need to look at the physics. The American Academy of Arts and Sciences has a new book out, The Physics of Space Security, that really talks about the technical and science limits from simply working in that kind of an environment.
And yet I wonder, Everett Dolman, earlier today I was talking with a retired Air Force general, and I asked him if he anticipated one day Star Wars-style space warfare, really along the lines of George Lucas' vision. And he answered without hesitation, yes, definitely. Is that where we're going? Or do you imagine, do you picture active battle warfare one day in space? Is this inevitable? Does it just come along with human habitation?
Well, you know, again, nothing is inevitable. Anything could sort of put the stop to that in the sense of a catastrophic meteor strike or something. But barring that and getting out into the projection area beyond 25 years, I think he's absolutely right. There will be conflict in space in the near term. What Dr. Johnson Fries and I are probably concerned about more is conflict from Earth to space and from space to Earth. Space-to-space capabilities have existed, and with the space shuttle probably could exist now. Laser weapons have a great deal of promise. The Air Force is developing and testing, I believe, an airborne laser mounted on a modified 737 that might have the capability to target space. That's not going to be its primary mission. But these notions, these ideas, these technologies do come along. And what I'm concerned about, of course, is Technology X. The unknown, the unanticipated technology that we cannot project because it's going to come from somewhere on the periphery that will change everything. And we need to be ready for Technology X, whether it makes it cheap to go into space, it makes certain weapons feasible, whether it turns everything around for another country. All of these things are important. So this discussion is very important. I've known Dr. Johnson Fries for some time, and she's a very, very deep thinker, but I do disagree on her preference for the hedging strategy, if I might bring that up.
You're saying go for it. Go for the real capacity.
The hedging strategy is designed to prevent an arms race in space in many cases. In fact, PAROS, the Prevention of an Arms Race in Outer Space Committee of the United Nations for the last 14, 16 years, has been meeting regularly and voting to have all nations sign a no-first-use declaration. And as Dr. Johnson Fries pointed out, four nations, including the United States and three much smaller ones, have abstained. Well, if I'm the leader of a small state that cannot develop space weapons, I will vote to have a declaration by the state that can not to do so, as the Romans knew. The mice will always vote to bell the cat. But by waiting, by hedging, by saying, okay, we won't put weapons into space at a time when we're the only nation that could and then could prevent an arms race, as Tim Weiner reported.
Maybe.
By waiting until other nations have that capability 15 years from now, 20 years from now, then we will have a space race.
I want to get one more call here. Leonard's calling from Boston. Leonard, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. This is an excellent discussion. Great points made on all sides. I have a point of view that says, I've heard a number of references to open navigation of the sea, but how could that be possible without a strong navy by the United States or the before us? I don't see how we could have that in space without a strong presence there as well.
If you've got to have a navy at sea, then you've got to have a military capacity in space if that's the next great heavenly ocean. That's your point, Leonard.
That's mine, yes.
Wow. Leonard, thanks very much for your call. Joan Johnson Freeze, here it is again. I mean, the heavens, you know, they were always beyond this. And now, in my conversations earlier today, talking with Everett Dolman, he's saying, yes, look out decades, and in all likelihood, we will see kind of George Lucas-style even combat in space. He says your hedging won't cut it. You've got to be out there. We've got to be out there in strength. Is it necessary? And there's this. Space is ultimately infinite, though not the envelope right around Earth. But does this vision outstrip earthly resources? Could this just be more than any superpower can really pull off?
Well, there's a lot of questions there, but to basically start with the last one, my fear is that the United States will not be placed in a position of an arms race with other countries, but almost in an arms race against itself, because every time we try and develop the unassailable weapon, somebody else only just has to find a way to thwart it, and then we're back on the treadmill trying to find something bigger and better. So that's one piece. In terms of, do we need to have a strong military, the naval analogy, we need to have a strong navy, so we need to be strong in space. I would argue that we have never had it so good in space. We've never been stronger. Washington spends almost $20 billion annually on military space activities. That's almost 90% of the global kind of pie, if you will. So we are very strong. What I wonder if, for those who don't like a hedging strategy, what would be the feeling towards, if you want to develop the weapons, having a no first use pledge by the United States? We might build it, but we won't use it unless somebody else does first.
But that's different from what we hear General Lance Lord, head of Air Force Space Command. He's talking about supremacy, about freedom to attack, freedom from attack.
I agree. And there's also, you know, I would bring up the Air Force often talks about not just space supremacy, which means better than others,
yes,
but space dominance. And that goes back to what was talked about earlier, that the United States, we see space differently than much of the rest of the world in terms of the rest of the world sees it as a global commons, and the United States increasingly is seeing it a U.S. strategic common, which it must control. And controlling space is a difficult task to take on.
But one that the Bush administration may very well, from all reports, give a green light to just in the coming weeks. Joan Johnson Freeze at the Naval War College, author of the forthcoming Heavenly Ambitions, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
And Everett Dolman in Montgomery, Alabama, professor of Comparative Military Studies at the School of Advanced Air and Space Studies at Maxwell Air Force Base. Thank you very much for being with us, Everett Dolman.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, writer Sue Monk Kidd pens her much-anticipated follow-up to The Secret Life of Bees. This is On Point. When writer Sue Monk Kidd penned her first novel, The Secret Life of Bees, at age 53, she had no idea what a sensation it would become. The book has sold over 3 million copies and spent a year and a half on the New York Times bestseller list. It's being taught in high school classes and has a movie in the works. Now Kidd is out with her second novel, The Mermaid Chair. The new novel centers on Jessie Sullivan, a married woman who returns to her childhood home, a fictional island off the South Carolina coast. There she meets and falls in love with a Benedictine monk, triggering a reawakening that jolts her out of her mundane life. Tonight, Sue Monk Kidd reads a passage from The Mermaid Chair and discusses the pressure she felt in trying to follow up on the blockbuster success of The Secret Life of Bees.
When I finished writing The Secret Life of Bees, it was about 10 months later when I got the idea for The Mermaid Chair. So I was writing that novel initially in a bubble of naivete. I had no sense that there was any pressure or expectation. And of course, eventually, it all dawned on me as The Secret Life of Bees became more and more popular. I began to get an idea that there really was going to be some comparison between these novels, and it was a little intimidating, to say the least. I had a moment when that crashed in on me. I was in the grocery store, and a woman said to me, "You know, I finally read your novel, The Secret Life of Bees, and it really is wonderful. I don't see how you could ever write another one that good." And I went home and thought, oh, yes, there really is going to be a huge amount of expectation. Now, there is that second novel thing you have to get over. And I took a few weeks to work that through. And when I look back, I think that's relatively short because I had to just tell myself that it was bad form, really, to compare your children, your literary offspring, and I needed to just write this novel with as much integrity as I could. And then I settled down and relaxed and wrote The Mermaid Chair. I'm going to read a passage from my novel, The Mermaid Chair. This is the prologue in which my character, Jessie Sullivan, is telling us about her story. In the middle of my marriage, when I was, above all, Hugh's wife and Dee's mother, one of those unambiguous women with no desire to disturb the universe, I fell in love with a Benedictine monk. It happened during the winter and spring of 1988, though I'm only now, a year later, ready to speak of it. They say you can bear anything if you can tell a story about it. My name is Jessie Sullivan. I stand at the bow of a ferry, looking across Bull's Bay toward Egret Island, a tiny barrier island off the coast of South Carolina where I grew up. I see it almost a mile out in the water, a small curve of russet and green. The wind is spiked with the smell of my childhood, and the water is ultramarine blue, shining like taffeta. Looking toward the northwest tip of the island, I can't yet see the spire from the monastery church, but I know it's there, pricking the white afternoon. I marvel at how good I was before I met him, how I lived molded to the smallest space possible, my days the size of little beads that passed without passion through my fingers. So few people know what they're capable of. At 42, I'd never done anything that took my own breath away, and I suppose now that was part of the problem, my chronic inability to astonish myself. I promise you, no one judges me more harshly than I do myself. I caused a brilliant wreckage. Some say I fell from grace. They're being kind. I didn't fall. I dove.
Writer Sue Monk Kidd, reading from her new novel, The Mermaid Chair. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.